Welcome to the Isles Buzz podcast. This is your one-stop shop for everything surrounding your New York Islanders. And now, here are your hosts, Dan Petru and Noel Fogelman.
And this is the Isles Buzz podcast alongside Dan Petru. My name is Noel Fogelman. Dan, what's going on?
Oh, not much. Just looking forward to another fantastic episode of the Isles Buzz podcast.
Yes. And we're going to look back as well as looking ahead during the show. Nick Hirshon, very talented writer, he is releasing a book called We Want Fish Stick. It comes out this Saturday. It's a fantastic read. And I had a chance to speak with him yesterday. The whole story about the rebranding, because there was a book, a very entertaining book, by Peter Boddy and Alan Hahn called Fish Sticks. I would say maybe 10 years ago it came out. And it was that book was pretty much just about that whole time, the whole Millbury time, leading up to the series against the Maple Leafs with the Sean Bates goal and everything like that. You know, Darcy Tucker, you know, cheap play against Michael Pekka, all that stuff. But it kind of didn't really go in-depth about the whole rebranding of the Islanders, and Nick's book does a great job about it. There's some great stories in there. It'll make you angry. It'll make you laugh. It's a good read, so I had a good interview with Nick. But what's not good right now, Dan? The power play.
It'll also make you angry and make you laugh.
Yeah, and definitely make you cry. November, and let's do NO in capitals because...
That was good.
Thank you, thank you. They're 0 for their last 11, and that's the last five games overall in November. A whopping 10%, 4 for 40.
Yeah, that's not going to cut it. And they had so many... Like, they didn't play great last night, but they were in that game for a large portion.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Like, you know, Tom Wilson, two goals. What makes me so angry with him, because he is such a talented player.
He is a good player.
That he has no reason to resort to his shenanigans.
And I know.
It's unfortunate. Honestly, I hope he does it again, because I want him out even longer. Because he's, you know, that much of an agitator. Being an agitator is fine, but don't cross the line.
Yeah, I mean, if he can just curtail how he plays, I mean, he really is becoming, he could be an all-star. He's really good.
Yeah.
Like, he could be a 60-point player, especially playing with Ovechkin and Backstrom.
Right.
Or Kuznetsov or whoever.
Right, and he's a first-round player, too.
Yeah, he is. He really, you know, it's like he's a better skating Milan Lucic.
Yeah, and he's, you know, buried now in Edmonton, that contract.
Well, that's because he can't skate.
yeah, definitely. But how do you fix the power play? I know Scott Gomez is under a lot of fire, and there's only so much he can do because the personnel isn't great. I don't like having four forwards on the top line because that means...
I don't have a problem with that at all. That doesn't bother me at all. 90% of the league uses four forwards.
Right, but when you... 90% of the league doesn't use a fourth line player on the second power play unit, though.
We'll get to the second unit in a second. Let's fix the first unit first. Part of the problem is you have a defenseman running the power play who refuses to shoot the puck. And no one respects a shot.
No. But the problem is Pulag can't find the side of a building right now with his shot.
Yeah, but once again, no one respects Letty, right? No one respects his shot. So everyone is shifted over. Pulag does not have the room he needs. Like, he needs to be able to get his shot off, and everyone knows where the puck is going.
Yeah, it's true, but there are other issues. I mean,
yes, Pulak needs to hit the net more, but I would put Letty in the second unit, and I would put Barzal back in the first unit, and you bump Clutterbuck off the second unit, and you put Filppula in the second unit because he deserves more ice time.
Yeah, and that's who I was going to mention, because everyone killed that signing as well as Komarov, but he's been unbelievable this year. I mean, he's got 7 goals already. He's got 16 points, and his last 7 games, he's got 8 points.
Yeah, that whole line's been good too. Komarov and Kunackel, it just works. I don't know quite how to explain it. And if you look at the math doesn't support it. But if you actually watch the game with your eyes, they're very effective.
Yeah, it's an X-Files line. It really is.
That's a great name for it.
You know,
it defies all logic.
Yeah, it's true. But the top six is fine. I mean,
top six is actually playing well for the most part. They are playing well. They seem to be clicking now.
Right. You can tinker by putting certain players on. They're all interchangeable. Those top six. Once Cizikas gets back, which will help. Fritz has been fine the last two games. The problem was not Michael Del Cole himself. It was just Michael Del Cole being there on the fourth line because he serves no purpose.
And there's nowhere else to play him right now.
Right. And, that's the only problem. Everyone screams for Kiefer Bellows to be up here.
No, there's Josh no reason Hosang, to. There's no place for him
right now. You can't bump one of the guys in the top six. You're not going to put Babouli on the fourth line the way he's playing. So you kind of have to have those players still be in Bridgeport. God forbid someone gets hurt, then you bring them up. There's no reason. That's why you bring up a Steven Gionta. That's why you bring up a Tanner Fritz. Those guys can play fourth line minutes.
Well, one of three things is going to happen. I mean, there'll be an injury to someone in the top six, and then you'll need someone skilled up there, and then those guys will get their chances. Or, everything will stay the same, and maybe they have to compete till next year, or this team will fall out of it. They'll trade some pieces at the deadline, and some of these kids will come up. So one of those three things will happen.
Yeah, hopefully not the last one. But
hopefully not either. Yes, that's
right. Yeah, exactly. But Cizikas should be back hopefully by the weekend. Matt Martin came back last night, so that was good. Otherwise, this team has been pretty healthy. I mean, I'm not counting Anders Lee. I mean, sorry, Andrew Ladd, who I don't know his timetable, but.
Yeah, there is none. Because someone asked that the other day, and there's absolutely no specific time. So it sounds like it's going to be serious. So, all things considered, yes, there's been some bumps and bruises, but they've been fairly healthy. They just need to figure out this blue line. It seems to be better now that Letty and it was back with Boychuk and Pulak is with Hickey. They both look better. Pulak looks considerably more comfortable with Hickey. And say what you want about Mayfield, but he comes to play every day. He's the perfect. Does he make mistakes? Yes. But he gives you an honest effort, and he's a good bottom pairing defenseman. It's just still, I feel like they're missing something back there. Maybe it's not something they can address right now, but the blue line is still a little ugh.
Was that a sneeze? Was that like a.
It was just an ugh. The blue line's okay. Just ugh. They'd still need more points from the blue line. It's just still not enough. There's zone coverage, and they're also they treat the puck like a live grenade sometimes. They don't realize how much time they have. So something is just missing back there, and I don't know. Obviously, it's probably someone who's more skilled. So I just really want to see Taze up there because the way Taze is playing, he's had no business to be in Bridgeport. But at the same time, who are you bumping? You can make the argument for Pelech, maybe, but he's been okay lately. I just really need Nick Leddy to look like Nick Leddy from 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, he had that Nick Leddy goal the other night against the Devils. You want to see more of that because he has
the talent. Doesn't have to score. I just want to see him carry the puck like that.
Yeah, you don't want to see him just skate to the blue line and then just, drop the drop pass again.
No, I hate that play. I hate that play so much. I hate it on the power play even more.
Yeah, because right there you're killing at least 5 seconds to 10 seconds off your power play right there. It's do it all the time, and it's frustrating.
But just gain the line, and then you can hit that guy as a trailer with a full head of speed.
Right. You don't want to do it past, center ice, because that seems like they always do that play. But
it just seems like his zone entries, he's not, with the exception of that goal, he does not carry the puck anymore.
No, definitely not. But they actually have a difficult schedule coming up.
It's brutal. It's the next three games are going to be if they can just go 1-1-1 in their next three games, I think that would be fine.
Yeah, because they have the Bruins coming up on Thursday. It's 8 o'clock game. Is it on NBC SN?
I don't know. 8 o'clock game. It must be if it's 8 o'clock.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. Unless there's something going on in Boston that had it. I don't know.
No, I can't. If it's 8 o'clock, it's got to be on NBC. Because don't they have one NBC game this year?
Or maybe it was just an error on NBC Plus's broadcast. Because I'm just looking now on the app, and it does say 7 o'clock. So maybe it's
okay. Then we'll blame MSG.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Then they Saturday is going to be an interesting night. Their first game back at the Coliseum since 2015. It's going to be rocking. It's interesting how their first regular season game there is against the Blue Jackets, and it was against the Blue Jackets that they played their last regular season game there as well.
I'm sure that's how it was planned.
Oh, absolutely. And that game was brutal. I remember they had the lead last couple of minutes. They blew it. They lost in a shootout, and that cost them a big point because they would have hosted that playoff series against the Capitals. And I think if they would have had home ice that series, they would have won.
Yeah, I mean, home ice is only as good as your starting goalie. But in that instance, the way that series went, a game seven in Nassau probably would have been great. Although you don't know what, you know, it's all semantics because they played so poorly in game seven. So it's like, you know.
Yeah, well, you know what would have helped? Playing Andrews Lee.
Oh, that's right. He was scratched for that game.
He was scratching game six and seven for Colin McDonald. Right. I know this is that's old right. news already, but and just remember, they had Vishnovsky got hurt, obviously at the hands of Tom Wilson. But people forget, they had Griffin Reinhart and they had Matt Donovan playing minutes in those games.
Oh, God. I completely erased that from my mind.
Yeah, and it's like, and they still made it to game seven. I mean, they didn't show up to game seven, but they made that a series. And game two, they won game one, which is like, wow, they, you know, got home ice right back. But then game two, Philip Grubauer started.
Because Holtby was sick.
Yeah, and it was like, oh, this is great. They can even go up 2-0. Didn't work out that way, but, you know, it's so funny. With all these Islander series, they always are able to get home ice. They always manage to split one of the two games.
And it's usually game one. They usually sneak up on a team and win game one.
Yeah, you know, and even going back like years, when the Sabres, when they played the Sabres, the whole Dubowitz getting them into the playoffs.
Tampa.
Ottawa.
Both times they played Tampa. When they lost to Tampa the cup year, and then most recently when they played Tampa, they sneak up on teams. Yeah. And the teams are like, what the hell are we doing? And then they crush them.
Right, exactly. But then the problem is, they're not able to, you know, maintain it at the Coliseum or Barclays now. But it's going to be a rocking Saturday. They have, I believe, 21 games now there?
Yes, 21, I believe, yes.
Yeah, and you know who we have to thank for these games now at the Coliseum?
Our owners?
Nope, not the owners, not the fans.
Lou Lamoriello.
Not even Lou, not even Mike Milbury, not even Garth Snow.
Governor Cuomo.
Not even Mario Cuomo. Not even Andrew Cuomo. I'm not even going to thank Trump. You know who I'm going to thank? I'm not even going to thank Gritty. I am going to thank the CEO of Barclays Center, Brett Yomark, because it was his genius idea to have the Islanders back at Nassau Coliseum. So
he's taking credit.
And you know what, Brett? Go away.
Please. Remember that SNL skit when they used to do a Weekend Update and it was Amy Poehler and Seth Meyers? Really?
Yeah.
Really, Brett?
Yeah, you know, no one wants to hear from you. Just send out your tweets about concerts that no one cares about or MMA fights that no one cares about or Ice Capades or Disney on Ice or whatever. Retweet to get in my owner's sweet boxes. That's all you're good for, to shut your mouth. Islanders will be out of there after this season. We won't have to worry about going to Brooklyn ever again.
Wow, Angry Noel. I love it.
And it's like you dig a hole for yourself every time you speak about the Islanders. And it just – there's no point. There's absolutely no point for it.
Leave the team out of your mouth. Leave the team's name out of your mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. So then following those two games, they play the Winnipeg Jets at home.
Yeah, and that Laine guy is scoring a few goals right now.
Yeah, he's been pretty good. And what does he have, like three hat tricks already?
Three hat tricks in the last 10 games
and
11 goals in his last four games.
In three different countries.
In three different countries. That's amazing. That's got to be a trivia question.
Yeah, I mean, that's nuts. You know he was going to get hot.
This is an obscene level of hot, though.
Yeah. I mean, because
he scored 5 goals on 5 shots.
Yeah. And you heard about that one fan, right? That won $1 million?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, that's great. I mean,
it was a million. It was a million Canadian, so it's at like $4.76.
I mean, it's enough to get you some Timbits from Tim Hortons and
I love the cherry vanilla Timbits. Oh, those are to die for.
It's so good. And then you ever go to the beer store in Canada?
Which one?
The beer store.
Yes, I have.
Oh my god, that place is magical. The conveyor belt that brings the beer to you. Oh my god,
it really is amazing.
It's so good. All right, here's Nick. We Won Fish Sticks, the bizarre and infamous rebranding of the New York Islanders. It's a fascinating read. It's from University of Nebraska Press. It comes out this Saturday, and I have the author, Nick Hirshon, on right now. Nick, how are you doing today?
Very good. Thanks so much for having me.
And right with the whole branding and the players during that, you have Eric Fischow, who, goaltender of the future for the Islanders, one of many, wrote the foreword. So how did you decide on getting Eric
to write the forward.
I interviewed a whole bunch of players for the book, and I think it ended up being 23 players who had at one time wore the Fisherman logo between 95 and 97. And Eric was one of the best interviews that I had. I just felt we connected really well. He was very open. He's a hockey analyst now for TVI in Canada. And maybe there was that media connection because I used to be a reporter. And so we just had a really good rapport very quickly. And he told me all these great stories. And then fast forward a few months later when I have to figure out who I get for the forward. And this actually is probably more like a year and a half later, I should say, when I'm getting the forward together. And I'm starting to think, like, who has a high profile? You want someone who has a pretty good social media presence, somebody who's still involved in hockey, and someone who just, you know, you get along with and would be a good partner on a project like that, because in a sense you are, you know, partners at least at the time they're writing the forward. So Eric just came to mind, and you know, sent him a message. He was on board, and I thought that his forward ended up being really great. A lot of inside stories, and gives you that kind of perspective that I can't provide inside the locker room when you're with your teammates. He talks about rooming with Brian McCabe, Brian Berard, and just getting to know those guys. And, you know, it was a great perspective. I'm glad he could add that.
Yeah, and it's so funny how many former Islander goaltenders are now, like, TV analysts. You have Eric, Jamie McLennan, Kevin Weeks, you had Glenn Healy, Kelly Rudy, you know.
Chico Resch.
You know, DiPietro, this radio show, worked on the Islander broadcast a little bit. So you have all these former Islander goaltenders who are still involved in the media.
Yeah. And I guess it's kind of like goaltenders in hockey are sort of like catchers in baseball, where they tend to think they're the brainiest ones, right, or the ones who have, you know, a different perspective on the game. Yeah, and honestly, some of the best interviews that I did for the book were Eric and Tommy Soderstrom.
Okay.
You know, who were just really interesting, open guys. And I had a lot of fun talking to them.
Right. So the whole concept of the book, how did you just first decide to write this and kind of torture yourself, so to speak?
Well, I was in my PhD program at Ohio University. I was going for a PhD in mass communication, and we needed to pick a topic for our doctoral dissertation, which is supposed to be this momentous manuscript, the final document that you submit that certifies that you're an expert in your field. And I want to do something relating to either the Mets or the Islanders, my two favorite teams growing up. And really, the Islanders have been such a big part of my life. So I try to think about, well, what stories were in Islanders history that relate to mass communication, which means anything about books, newspapers, TV, radio, any sort of media. And I started thinking about the Fisherman jersey controversy and how no one had really written a book about it before. No one had really gone deep into it. And there was a book that came out, Fish Sticks, in 2002 by Alan Hahn and Peter Boddy. But even though it's called Fish Sticks, it's a great book, but it really refers more broadly to what was happening to the franchise over the years and went all the way up to the Sean Bates penalty shot goal 2002. And I want to do a very deep dive into this one specific 3-year period when the rebrand was at its height. So I decided that would work. I went to my dissertation director. I said, would this count as mass comm? And she assured me that it would, because the logo itself was a form of mass communication. It was one icon going out to many different people. And then, of course, I could look at the newspaper and TV coverage and how they mock the jersey and all of that. So that's really how it came about.
Yeah. How long did it actually take you to write the book?
It was about about 1 year of intense work. There was, I kind of view my life in semesters, because I was in a doctoral program and now I'm a journalism professor. So it was in the fall of 2015, I was doing all of the research. So interviewing all the players, I ended up interviewing 53 different people for the book, doing archival research, newspapers, microfilm, going to the MSG Networks archives to get the old Sports Channel broadcasts, getting old Islanders programs, The Blade, getting the fan newsletters from the time, like The Seventh Man, Islanders Insider. And that was really in the fall. And then in the spring of 2016, I really went into the writing. So, I mean, there was some overlap, obviously, but I would say from start to finish, it was about a year for that project.
Right. Now, did you have to like reach out to the Islanders organization itself? Were they, you know, accommodating to you?
I actually didn't reach out to the Islanders as part of the process. I reached out to a lot of Islanders players and people, you know, working for the Islanders broadcast team and all of that. Just people who were involved. Honestly, there was no one
left,
still,
right?
You know, with the Islanders who was involved in the rebranding. Right. So it was, I reached out to the NHL Players Association to help get some of these guys, track them down, and the NHL Alumni Association. Yeah, that was mostly how I went about that research.
Right. Now, this is basically, I mean, it's an easy question to answer, I think, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If had the team been good, would this have been an issue?
You know, that's a fundamental question that's at the heart of this book, right? Yeah. I think the Fisherman logo still would not have been well received just because it was such an abandonment of the dynasty era tradition.
Right.
And so many Islanders fans have a fondness for that original NY logo with the map of Long Island on it. So no matter what, if they were going to move away from that logo so starkly, and remember, the Fisherman was not a third jersey. It was a replacement. They were getting rid of the old logo and authoritatively saying, we think this old logo is from the past and it's time to move on and give these players a new image. So I think that there was going to be an uphill battle no matter what. That said, in sports, winning is everything, and winning can cure everything. So if you have, you know, Mike Milbury coming in and Ziggy Palfy scoring a bunch of goals and a lot of excitement around the team and they're making the playoffs, and John Spano's sale goes through and he becomes this amazing owner, then, yeah, you start to have a positive association with the logo. Part of what my argument is in the book is that it's not the logo itself is aesthetically unpleasing or terrible.
Right.
It's really that it became so tied up with all these other negative things that were happening to the team. So it was hard to detach it from Kirk Muller refusing to come to the Islanders and Mike Milbury shoving and spitting at players and John Spano being outed as a con artist after he's depicted as the savior who's going to lead the Islanders back to the Stanley Cup. And all of these other zany little mishaps that happened in between, I think that the logo would have been received a lot differently.
Yeah, probably. Hey, you're probably right. Just reading it, it was like this should have been like Slapshot 4 or something like that. This was like legitimately more Hollywood than Slapshot itself. I don't want to really go to too many stories because I want people to read the book. It's, you know, it's entertaining. But just the whole what symbolized Long Island, and I really got a chuckle out of that. They're trying to figure out, you have Miami, you think palm trees, you have San Francisco, you think Golden Gate Bridge, obviously Philly, Liberty Bell, Long Island. What do you think of Long Island? I like what they wrote in that Times, New York Times article about how it's a woman with a shopping, Bloomingdale shopping bag going into a Lexus.
Yeah. I mean, and see, that question really interested me too, because I think that is another, another fundamental problem for the Islanders as a franchise is they don't have much of an identity. The only identity the team has really, even to this day, is we won 4 straight Stanley Cups. Right. We were the best dynasty in sports history, maybe. And that's a great identity to have, don't get me wrong. But beyond that, if you ask the average person from anywhere in the country, what do you think about when I say the words Long Island, they struggle. Some people might associate it with the beaches. Some people associate it with Teddy Roosevelt living in Sagamore Hill. Some say the Hamptons. But there's not like one definitive idea of what Long Island represents. And so the Islanders, when they're rebranding, they're struggling. And as you say, there's at one point one of the executives jokes, and this was never obviously seriously under consideration, but jokes that the ideal image of Long Island is a woman stepping out of Bloomingdale's of a shopping bag going into a Lexus. But, you know, it is this wider issue. And then they start going to, you know, tropical imagery like, well, palm trees, sunsets, sunrises. But that's really more associated with a tropical island, not Long Island. You know, that may work in Florida or the Bahamas or something, but not here. And then they move on to seafaring images and crabs and seagulls and boats and the fishermen. So But that, I think, is a problem, and I think that's another reason why The Fisherman did not resonate with the fan base, because is it iconic of a part of Long Island? Yes. Of Long Island history or certain sections? Yes. But for tons of people who grew up in Long Island, I mean, my dad grew up in North Merrick. My grandparents lived there when I was growing up. I'm sure that on an average day, they never saw ships or fishermen.
Right.
Just it was not part of their experience. And that's just something that is hard to, you know, work into a mascot or a logo.
Yeah. And during that time, you had like kind of the boom of the cartoonish logos, like you mentioned in the book. Obviously, the Mighty Ducks, the Sharks, even to some extent the Panthers. The logo itself, I feel, would have worked if perhaps they got rid of the fishermen and just kept, maybe put a lighthouse where the I was and made it Islanders. The spelling, because the text itself was pretty sleek.
Yeah, and that was one of the ideas that they had, was create just what they call a word mark, right, where it would just be the word Islanders with a different kind of font, like you mentioned, maybe having the I and Islanders become a lighthouse. And that lighthouse patch that they ended up putting on the shoulders, that really is one of the most popular parts of that fisherman jersey. It's one that fans still talk about today. And I think if that was the main crest and the fisherman was the shoulder patch, then that also would have been received a lot differently. But there were all these other ideas. One of the executives for the team says they were going to have the word Islanders in maybe a Superman kind of font from the old Christopher Reeve movies.
Right.
But, you know, they end up really wanting to do something bold. And as you mentioned, the Mighty Ducks, the San Jose Sharks, they sold tons of jerseys. In some cases, the Mighty Ducks, before they'd even played a single game, they were the NHL's best-selling jersey. Yeah. Based on a cartoonish logo. And that's one of the things that the Islanders are looking for. Okay, you can't just have like an Islanders word mark. If you really want to hit people with something and you want to be that kind of icon of when you go to an airport and you want a souvenir of where you're from, where you just visited, you want something more than just the word Islanders. And so they decided to go with the fisherman.
Yeah, and probably more killed than the actual logo was poor Niles himself.
And, yeah.
And I guess his origin story, you know, or how long he lasted, it's kind of still up in the air. It was mentioned in the book, but the whole resemblance, which was between Carl Malden or Lanny and Jakes McDonald, it was very, you know, a fire hydrant with the facial hair, and then he had the goal light, you know, that the hat, where they scored, the light would go on. How was it interviewing the guy who played him? Because his story was fascinating.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A lot of people who have read the book so far pick up on Rob DiFiore, who played Niles at the start. And it was a very interesting interview. I was glad I could track him down. I just had read a New York Times article where they interviewed him around the time he started as the Islanders mascot, which was actually before they even unveiled the Fisherman logo itself. So Niles started out wearing the traditional Islanders logo in the spring of 1995, and they don't unveil the logo until the June of 1995 in the summer. But yeah, he was, you know, a very interesting character, because he, before he became the Islanders mascot, he had been the mascot for St. John's University's basketball team. And when they were moving away from being the Red Men to the Red Storm because of that controversy, right, about the Native American imagery of their name. And he became their mascot, Johnny the Beast, and really resonated with fans. But then by the time that he's becoming the Islanders mascot, he's gone through a lot in his life. He struggled with alcoholism. He was addicted to cocaine. He suffered from depression and kind of had bounced around other jobs totally unrelated to sports. He, you know, is hired to be the mascot, and he realizes that the costume that they're putting him in is so bulky, so heavy, that he can't really do the kind of antics that mascots are expected to do. So he's kind of doing the best that he can, but then he becomes a living embodiment of this logo and this rebrand that everybody dislikes. So it's an easy target for fans. And there's stories in the book about people kicking him, punching him, you know, kicking him in the groin, lots of terrible things happening until towards the end of his time as the Islanders mascot, where he used to wear a motorcycle battery around his waist that would charge that goal light atop his helmet that you mentioned. And one day he's about to go out into the arena and the motorcycle battery catches fire. And he's trying to quickly shed his costume and realizes, you know, I'm doing this as a part-time employee. I think he was only getting 175 bucks a night or something like that. And, you know, he asked the Islanders for more money, maybe a full-time salary and some other sorts of perks. And they're just like, see you later. You know, if you're going to ask for anything like that, then you're out. But, you know, in talking to him, even to this day, you could tell that was a big part of his identity. And the guys who are inside those outfits, maybe we don't think about it, but he was the only guy really at that time playing it. Later on, Niles was also played by Rich Walker, who I also interviewed for the book. But, you know, that becomes who you are. And when you see a photo of Niles, you're like, I know that's me inside. The fans may not realize it. So then to be fired, it's almost like telling you, leave your skin. You know, you can't be in this body anymore. It was a very rude awakening and something that, you know, clearly affected him. And you could tell that passion and kind of disappointment in his voice 25 years later.
Yeah, and there's some other really good, interesting stories, some funny ones about just his experience. And I don't want to, you know, really mention them because I want just people to read the book. But what surprised you most about writing this book?
Huh. I mean, I guess there are so many things about what Mike Milbury did as the coach. Here's, you know, a lot of it is like I went into this project. I was an Islanders fan, but I became a fan in 1999, so I didn't know the full context about how Milbury had come into the franchise. Right. I didn't know about the Fisherman jersey logo so much. But I knew about Mike Milbury because he had been the general manager for, you know, the start of my fandom, and I knew that he had wacky ways. I knew about the Mad Mike moniker and all the crazy trades he had made, you know, trading away seemingly anybody who had any potential on the Islanders or anybody who merited a pay raise. But going back to the summer of 1995, when the Islanders have just unveiled this logo and now they want to hire a new coach, they had gotten rid of Lorne Henning, who had been there, you know, coach the previous season. And there's a lot of media pressure, specifically from Jim Smith, who was a columnist for Newsday and the Islanders beat writer for a while, where he's imploring them, you have to get Mike Milbury. And there was a headline in the paper that says, Isles need Milbury. And, you know, again, seeing it today is like kind of so stark. And someday I'll share that on my Twitter account. I'm sure I'll get a lot of reaction from Isles fans. But seeing, you know, all around the way that the Milbury hiring was received as the Islanders finally did something big league. They finally went professional and got a guy who had led the Bruins to the 1990 Cup final, who was a former hockey player himself, even though he's best known for beating a man with his own shoe in the stands at Madison Square Garden in 1979. So I think that just the media response to his hiring, and then even though I knew that he was wacky, I just kind of heard that but not heard specific stories. So then talking to the players and reading the newspaper coverage from the time and realizing, wow, he did like all of these sorts of crazy things, and he's getting into such an argument with Wendell Clark, for example, that players have to restrain Wendell and make sure that they're not going to have a brawl in the locker room. I mean, it's just it was kind of crazy to hear all of that and really get confirmation, because, you know, you're always a little bit skeptical. Okay, people say he's Mad Mike, and then when you actually look at some of this stuff, you're like, oh, all right, there is some truth to the rumors.
Right, and even spitting at Ulf Samuelsson, who, if he's not on your team, you hate the guy, and you actually have sympathy for Ulf Samuelsson, which which makes, you know, Milbury, like, you know, that much more hated, and basically, you know, saying he has a hard time teaching his kids not to spit at each other at home. That's what Ulf said after the game, and it's fascinating. Milbury treated that roster for the few years like it was his own personal fantasy hockey team.
Yeah, and the incident with Ulf Samuelsson, what's even more astounding is, of course, there were cameras everywhere, fans saw it, players saw it, but Milbury denies that it happened. And he tells the reporters right after that, I would never spit at a player, even if I disliked him. The newspapers dub it Watergate, you know, because of the spit. And then years later, I was watching the NHL Network as I was doing my dissertation. NHL Network, NBC had a game on. And Mike Milbury is the analyst, and he admits that he actually did spit at Ulf Samuelsson, and that he lost a lot of respect for Ulf Samuelsson after he then went to the media and said, Milbury spit at me. And the other announcers who were standing by his side during this broadcast are incredulous, like, wait, you lost respect for Ulf Samuelsson because he told other people that, you know, you had spit at him? Shouldn't he be losing respect at you? You know, it just, he has this wacky way of viewing that. And I will say that with some of the trades that he made, I give him a little bit of an out because he was working on such a tight budget. And so some of the moves that he made, I wonder if they're just a matter of, I can't afford to keep this guy. He's going to ask for a big contract in the offseason. We'll lose him for nothing, whatever. So he ends up going out and, you know, and swapping personnel. But some of them are just one of the problems of the rebrand is that there was no player who was like consistently there who you could say was the face of the rebrand. You know, Pat Flatley is their captain at the start of the rebrand.
He was He's already past his prime.
You know, they have, as you mentioned, you know, who's the goalie of the future? Well, it depends on who you ask whatever day. Sometimes it was Erik Fischel. Some days it was Tommy Soderstrom. Some days it was Tommy Salo, who was also wearing the Fisherman logo before he went on to become an all-star player, you know, elsewhere. They have Ziggy Palfy, and he is consistently on the team that period, although it's, you know, the real start of his career. But the Islanders kind of stunningly don't market him, even though he seems to have a lot of the traits you'd want in a marketable player. He's young. A lot of the girls find him good looking. They're wearing Ziggy Palfy wigs to the games. He's a very dynamic, outgoing sort of player. Even though he can't speak English that well when he starts on the team, he takes English classes to improve his marketability and just the way he can communicate with teammates and coaches and the media. And of course, he's just an incredible scorer, you know, one of the most talented guys to ever play for the Islanders, you know. So it's kind of amazing they didn't have anybody to shepherd that through. The real standard bearers and the real consistent people were Mike Milbury, pretty much, who was there for all of it. And then later on, they market John Spano as being the face of the rebrand. And look where that ended up.
Yeah.
So, you know, that I think is a, is another problem there, because maybe fans would have gravitated towards this new look if it was being worn by players who they really loved.
Right. And, you know, with Palfy, he was the Islanders' version of Jaromír Jágr. And they ended up re-signing him, and, you know, the whole issues with his agent, the whole Village Idiot comment, and then ending up trading him to the Kings in, I think, in 99 for basically nothing.
Yeah, and it's a shame, you know. And I, again, one of my earliest memories of going to an Islanders game, which must have been in 2000 or something, when I saw Ziggy Palfy come and play, you know, for the Kings, play against the Islanders, and just hearing people clap for him. And I didn't really know much then because I was a new Islanders fan. But now, like, when I went back in my research and watching his play, it's, you know, the kind of guy who we were lucky to be able to see on Long Island for a few seasons. It was too short, and it would have been great if he had stayed there, and, you know, he could have really helped them for a while. But it's also like the Islanders just didn't know what they had, I think, and they were so reluctant because he wasn't everything. Maybe he wasn't going to be a team leader. Okay, maybe he wasn't going to develop into a captain. That's just not his personality. But you could not be a captain and still be a guy who people really connect with, be a fan favorite, and, you know, people are going to buy those jerseys. So it's just surprising that they didn't catch on to that earlier.
Yeah, and even a guy like Matthew Schneider, who ended up being the captain for a little bit with them, you know, traded in the infamous Kurt Muller trade. I'll talk about him in a second. But someone who, from New York, wanted to stay with the Islanders, one of the few guys, they ended up shipping him out. His stay in the island was less than a year.
Yeah, and that's, again, it's the story of almost everybody on the Islanders in this period. They come and they go. They get Kirk Muller. They think that he's going to be the face of it. He refuses to report for a while and then ends up getting sent home and eventually traded. You know, you get Matthew Schneider, becomes an all-star defenseman for the Islanders. He's gone after a while. Erik Fischel is the goaltender of the future. He's out. You know, Brian Berard, rookie of the year, he's gone. You know, all of these guys who were very talented, you know, and for a period, Wendell Clark. And I actually own a Wendell Clark Fisherman jersey. And yeah, Wendell Clark comes to the team and you think, ah, now they got a veteran presence and some guy who really was a hit in Toronto. And then Milbury has a terrible relationship with him, and he's gone before long. So that's another reason why I think this rebrand is remembered so terribly, because there was just no one that you could really latch on to and say, you know, at least we had so-and-so. They're all gone. They all went on. If they did become good players, and many of them did, it was with other franchises.
Yeah, and like he really had no vision of the team. He kept trading young players. He ended up trading McCabe and Todd Bertuzzi, who him and Milbury never really meshed, for Trevor Linden. Who was a little bit past his prime at that point. I mean, he wanted the leadership. I guess they figured it didn't work out with Mueller. We'll try Trevor Linden at this point.
Yeah, and and that's towards the end of this rebrand. When they are trying to move away from the fisherman era, right, and they actually have Dennis Potvin come onto the ice and give the captain's jersey to Trevor Linden, which is a nice moment of showing that continuity. It's what the Islanders should have been doing all along in this rebranding. Instead of just conclusively moving away from mm-hmm. all of these players,
exactly,
you need to embrace them. You need to say they're a part of our history. The fans love them. Okay, we're not going to still have Dennis Potvin lacing up the skates, when he's 50, but to have some of them in the organization as scouts, as broadcasters, as coaches, to at least bring them back as ambassadors and, have them at ceremonies. And obviously the team has been much better at doing that in recent decades. And as I was growing up as a fan, you know, I was at the game where they raised Brian Trottier's number to the Raptors. I was there for Bill Torrey night. You know, so they did a lot of that kind of stuff. But in this era, Mike Milbury is hired, and he, in one of his first public comments, basically criticizes the Dynasty era players for staying on the Islanders for too long, way past their primes, and tying the Islanders' hands so that they were going to slide down into the NHL cellar. The moment with Potvin giving the jersey over to Linden is at least a sign of there's some continuity, there's history there. We want to move forward, but we also want to respect where we came from.
Right. Yeah, especially when you have the 25th anniversary of your team and you're trying to push away those legends.
Exactly. It doesn't make a lot of sense when you're going into your 25th anniversary season. And it's been a problem for the Islanders that all their history, and I think you see it in this era too, where they're kind of indecisive about, we have this great history, and that is always going to be a selling point for us. It's always going to be a marketing point. Even if the team is in last place, if we say we're going to invite back the Dynasty guys for some tribute night, fans will come out of the woodwork. Guys who haven't been to an Islanders game in years will say, I want to see Mike Bossy one more time. But at the same time, there is some concern that if you market those guys and we just keep talking about the increasingly distant run of Stanley Cups, it reminds us how far the Islanders have fallen. And it puts added pressure on the current players because, you know, they're just in this era, they're just trying to win a few games. And then meanwhile, they're being compared to Dynasty players, Hockey Hall of Famers. There's a few lines in the book where Todd Bertuzzi was expressing, some annoyance about being constantly compared to Clark Gillies. And he's saying, you know, I want to be my own player. And it's not anything against Clark Gillies. It's just, you know, I want to move past that.
Right. And he's absolutely right.
Yeah, and I think that that's a fair point, and that's actually one of the arguments for going with the Fisherman logo that I understand. I still think they didn't need to completely get rid of the old logo, but I understand, you know, times change, logos change, the players are going to change, so, you know, and fans change, and, you know, you're getting certainly now into a whole generation of where you may have the majority of people at any given Islanders game who weren't even alive when they last won a Stanley Cup. And that's, you know, certainly the case for me. I was not alive when they last won a Stanley Cup. So it's, you know, something that they, you know, had to think about at that time. But there was so much problem with the execution in other ways that it was bound to fail.
Yeah, I think it was his junior in college up in Buffalo when the news broke about the logo and the whole story came out. I got home for the official release, but Buffalo had their own rebranding during that time too. They went to the what they have now with, you know, their old logo, went to the red, black, and white. But they had success in that. They went to a Stanley Cup. Unfortunately, Islanders could not get past seventh place in the Atlantic. But Well, one thing I just wanted to touch upon, which I did not know in this book, and I found it pretty typical for the Islanders, how Milbury became general manager.
Yeah, that's a crazy part of this narrative too, because when Don Mahoney hired Mike Milbury as his coach, a lot of the media was speculating that, well, Mahoney better hope that the team performs, because if he gets into a slide, Milbury may just replace him as general manager. But when he is fired, which I think is in December of 1995, so it's only a few months into the season, you have the coach who's led this team to a last place record then assuming the dual roles of coach and general manager. It seems a little bit odd, like, you did so terrible that we're going to give you a promotion. And not only the lack of success on the ice, but just that he had had a record of kind of crazy behavior, the going into the stands in 79 most famously, but also just he had accepted a job, I believe, at Boston College very right. briefly, and then quits very mysteriously, like a month in before they play a single game. He has a falling out with the Bruins when he leaves their organization. And when he was with Boston, he had a lot of success because he had players like Cam Neely and Ray Bourque. The Islanders did not have that kind of a talent-laden roster. So giving the reins of general manager to him and really having no oversight, which I think was remarkable, and it happened to Milbury for much of his run under all those different ownership right. groups. Ownership kept changing, and the one consistent thing was Mike Milbury as your general manager. And I think they just entrusted this fully to him. So he's saying crazy things in the media, getting into arguments with players and agents, putting himself behind the bench, back in the executive office, back behind the bench. And no one's there to say, stop it, you know, or refuse a trade or say, you know, we're going to keep Ziggy Palfy even if you think he's a bad influence. Look at what he's producing. So giving the reins of the franchise over to Mike Milbury for so long is really a terrible period in the Islanders' history.
And do you think because he said that he won't take a salary increase got him the job?
I think that that's probably the biggest reason the Islanders were trying to save money in this era. The main reason why they adopted a fisherman jersey is they wanted something new to sell fans. And it wasn't going to, you know, they weren't going to be able to spend a lot of money on upgrades to Nassau Coliseum, buy players who people want to come to see. So the easiest way of doing that is unveiling a new jersey. And with Milbury, I think, you know, he was willing to accept the dual role of coach general manager without a bump in his salary. He was already one of the best paid coaches in hockey. I think they gave him a 5-year deal worth $3.5 million. So he's, you know, already making a lot of money for the Islanders. And yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what they do, because they say they do some sort of exhaustive search. But how exhaustive could it really be when it's in the middle of a season and – I didn't really hear many reports of them interviewing other people. It was mostly, you know, they fired Don Mahoney. There's some talk about Al Arbour is going to lead this search committee for a new general manager. And very quickly, Milbury assumes that role.
Yeah, because they had Darcy Regier there. He was basically an organizational man for forever. After Milbury fired him, he went up to Buffalo and had some success up there. Maybe he would have been the only like candidate for the role.
Yeah, he might have been another candidate. And, I mean, there were probably lots of former NHL GMs, recently fired NHL GMs, who were still on the market at that time, or maybe assistant GMs of other clubs who would have been willing to move to Long Island to take the big job. But as I recall, looking through the news clippings at the time, there was a pretty thorough search for the coach right. when they ended up going with Milbury, because they also interviewed Barry Melrose, who was also an ESPN analyst at the time, as Milbury was. And a bunch of other guys. But with the general manager search, it seems to be very quick. So I'm not thinking there was much of a process there beyond he's willing to do this without taking a bump in salary. Let's just give it to him.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. This is one story that, like, basically fascinated me, and it's like just shook my head at the same time. One of the, I guess, Gang of Four. I think it was Stephen Walsh. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was Robert Rosenthal, who was watching an Islander Ranger game in his office, I guess. And Art Feeney, who was the editor of the Islander Insider at the time, walked by, Rangers scored, and he saw Robert cheering for the Ranger goal.
Yeah, and Art Feeney, as you say, was a fan who was involved in the Saved Islanders Coalition and also was the editor of the Islander Insider and the Seventh Man newsletter. And yeah, he says that he saw Rosenthal and one of the other owners, it may have been Stephen Walsh, in the owner's box during an Islanders-Rangers game, and the Rangers score, and like Rosenthal leaps to his feet or something and celebrates because I guess he grew up a Rangers fan, right, or something. I don't know. And I don't know. I can't vouch for the veracity of that story.
Right.
I haven't seen any other reports about that. Art's the only one who, you know, really made that point. But I think it does speak to the suspicion that Islanders fans have towards whoever's in the owner's box, which kind of continues to this day. But you had a period where, you know, as Tom Croak, another one of the fans from the Save the Islanders Coalition, said, we lead the league in convicted felons.
Oh, absolutely.
Because,
yeah.
You know, you have obviously John Spano in this era becoming a felon. Right. And I think he's still in prison now because he's been going in and out.
Right. Sanjay Kumar.
And, you know, there's a line in the book that I saw some fans picking up on, you know, some fans who got early copies where I say, you know, letters sent to their correctional facilities were not returned. And I actually did, you know, I was thinking, well, I want to get Stephen Walsh, who a lot of people say Stephen Walsh was the owner most responsible for the Fisherman logo. And I think Paul Greenwood is also in jail right now. And I wanted to get their side of the story, or at least give them an opportunity to talk. And I, you know, so I sent those letters to the correctional facilities, but, there's suspicion there, and I can understand it even to this day. I mean, I have no reason to think that there's anything wrong with Ledecky or Malkin, but I can understand after all that Islanders fans have been through that you're just going to look there and be like, are they really who they say they were? You know, John Spano said he was this high roller and he turned out to be a fraud, and all these other guys end up in jail. Sanjay Kumar ended up in jail. You know, one of the co-owners who bought the team in 2000 with Charles Wong. So, I understand where all of that is coming from.
Yeah, I'm going to end the interview on this one. Kurt Muller, who basically, in any sport that I'm a fan of, I'll root for the player, whether I like them or not. I'll root for them to do well on the field, on the ice, on the court, whatever. Kurt Muller was the lone exception. Whatever. I mean, the trade was terrible to get Kurt Muller here. I understand the reasoning, but everyone kills Mike Milbury, and rightfully so, but the whole downturn in the organization basically fell in Don Maloney's shoes.
Yeah. There's a lot that just throughout this entire narrative that is kind of amazing about Kurt Muller. And, you know, when they get Kurt Muller, he's a point-a-game player. He's the captain of the Montreal Canadiens, very proud player, had played for Jersey with a rebuilding team for a while and showed that he was a gritty, gutsy kind of a player. And then the Islanders trade for him, and you think, all right, you know, they got rid of Pierre Turgeon in the deal, which is hard to stomach, but he had not been performing at that point for the Islanders. They get rid of Vladimir Malakhov, who his time had really run out here, and he did not seem to be enjoying playing on Long Island anymore. And you get Matthew Schneider in return, who becomes an all-star defenseman. So that part of the trade certainly works out for the Islanders. And just a good media guy, a good fan favorite. You know, he's an approachable person. But Kirk Muller, you really thought he could be the captain of this team, maybe. He could be the standard bearer of the franchise through this rebrand. And unfortunately, he refuses to report. The media attention of that just becomes embarrassing for the Islanders. And it's a shame. I tried to interview Kurt Muller for this book, and he declined. But, you know, I understand that he was going through a lot at that period because you're traded from a team that you captain to a Stanley Cup. You live in Montreal. You have an affinity for the place. So it's difficult. It's an experience that as fans, we don't really know what that's like. You know, no one's going to call you up tomorrow and say, "Noel, you know, sorry, you got traded to some team that plays in Arizona." And, you know, all of a sudden you have to uproot your life and go over there with your family and everything. But still, hockey players, athletes, they should be used to some of that. And after a while, you've still got to be a professional and show up to work. And this impression that he was tanking, which seems to be supported by the statistics at the time, right. Where he used to be a point-a-game player, now he's scoring like 1 point every three or four games, and just he's sulking, and constantly in media interviews he's bringing up the fact that he wants to renegotiate his contract. He doesn't like that, you know, the conversion rate between the Canadian and U.S. dollar is not generous to him. It just is unbecoming of a professional athlete.
Yeah, especially a captain of one of the most respected franchises in all of sports. And you look at a player, even years later, Ryan Smith, Captain Canada, got traded from Edmonton to the Islanders. He cried at the press conference. But you know what? He was a professional, came here, took the Islanders to the playoffs, but he left as he had the right to in the offseason, but he was a professional and he carried himself in that way.
Yeah, and that's a really good comparison to Ryan Smith because, again, we get it, right? Like if someone is traded somewhere where they spent a lot of time, maybe even where they grew up, they're leaving all their teammates, so all their close friends. Maybe they have to leave their family behind for a while they get a new home set up and everything. It's a lot to deal with, but you kind of, you know, you can cry at the press conference, and I think fans will forgive that, but then show up and play. And what was even more infuriating, if you remember in the book, there are quotes from Kirk Muller where he goes to a few press conferences when he finally does show up on Long Island, and they're asking him about his style of play, and he says, "I show up to play every night." It's right. A direct quote that he says in multiple different interviews about, you know, "The one thing you know you're getting out of me is that I show up to play every night." And it's like, man, you just didn't show up to play for like two or three games. So that's a very poor choice of words.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of fusing the whole cup winning teams to that point, he was wearing number 9. You know, Clark Gillie is one of the hardest workers in the Islanders' history. So it was very, you know, unfortunate that he had to wear that number.
Yeah, unfortunately gave a blemish to that number, I guess, for a while. And watching back some of the footage, you know, there's a video I pulled from YouTube as part of my research that shows the Islanders players being introduced at the start of that 95-96 season, the first season they wore the fisherman jerseys. And they're introducing all the different players coming out, and Kirk Muller is one of the few that gets the booze from the crowd. I think it's him and maybe Derek King get some booze, and Derek King was an enigmatic player and, you know, had a kind of a love-hate relationship with the fans at times. But, it's a shame that if he works out, you see, there's all these moments in this, what I view as a three-season-long rebranding, because the first season was introducing Niles as the mascot. The second season was introducing the logo and Mike Milbury. And the third season is introducing John Spano and still going with the fisherman jersey and seeing if that can survive. At any point there could have been some good fortune that struck them and maybe fans come around to this logo. And Kirk Muller is one of those situations where if he comes here, and even if they don't win a ton, but it just seems like he's a respectable player, he brings some professionalism to Long Island, then you look back at this and say, you know, they gave it their best effort, and at least he was a likable player. But he comes in on such terrible terms, and as soon as he arrives, he's already public enemy number one.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. And at least, like, we'll kill Milbury for his trades. At least he got something for Kurt Muller. You know,
yeah.
He made a bad situation a little more tolerable. But I like the picture in the book of, because I'm a big starting lineup collector, and I still am to this day. But the one figure that had the fisherman jersey was, unfortunately, Kurt Muller. I refused to buy that figure. I remember it had the card. He was in his Montreal Canadiens jersey.
Exactly right. Wow, you have a great memory for that. I'm actually looking at right now. I have right here on my shelf my little Kirk Muller starting lineup statuette.
Right.
And as you say, the photograph, which I took of my own figurine,
right.
The photograph in the book, you know, it shows that, and it says that It is the only mass-produced figurine ever made of a player in Islanders fisherman jersey. And you know, and I actually bought later on. I saw someone had made, I believe it's a Brian Berard or Brian McCabe statuette that I bought that was just like a custom-made one of those McFarland pieces.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's. I obviously now I collect some fisherman logo stuff just because it was part of my research and it's my book. And so it's something that I have an affinity for. I was surprised that they didn't market it even more. I get that it wasn't the most popular logo when it came out. But again, if you make that stuff available, maybe people are a little bit more open to it. I was surprised there was absolutely no merchandise I can ever tell that was made with Niles, the mascot.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, which is kind of stunning to me because nowadays you go to an Islanders game, right?
Sparky's everywhere.
Yeah, for years there were like, you know, I went with my friend one time to a game and she bought the Sparky hat, you know, where you have the little dragon horns on the top or whatever. And there's shirts with Sparky and there's Sparky plush dolls and all this sort of thing. And I'm a Mets fan. And of course, Mr. Met is everywhere, as you can imagine. But yeah, there's – I couldn't find anything. At one point I did find – a little catalog called Isle Style that was like a mail order catalog, you know, four or five pages that just had some things you could get. And there was like a fisherman logo umbrella and a fisherman logo t-shirt, which actually I bought years ago and I have somewhere. Right. But yeah, there wasn't as nearly as much. And I think that also shows us, even though it was pretty recent, right? We're talking 95, 96 and 97, but people still didn't think about sports branding as this moneymaker, as this tool of, you know, you can market to kids and even kids who don't know nothing about hockey, don't really care about sports. They just think, oh, it's a plush dragon. That's a fun thing to take home. Or the dragon made me laugh when I was at the game because he did something silly on the ice. And there wasn't enough of that discussion going on in the Islanders executive offices back then.
Yeah. The only thing that would have made this time more enjoyable if social media was around.
Oh, man, I've thought so much about it because I'm a big person on Twitter and Instagram and everything. And, you know, and of course, we all know what Isle's Twitter is like.
Oh,
it has its own hashtag because people overreacting to things or just, you know, going crazy about stuff. So, yeah, I wonder because when the Islanders brought back the Fisherman logo in warmups for one game in February of 2015 – the fan reaction was immediate and I knew that it was going to happen. So I was monitoring Twitter and I was capturing all of those tweets that night because I wanted to include them in my book. And, you know, I mentioned one guy calls it a swastika or says Isles fans are, I guess, reacting to it as if it is a swastika. Right. And then people are just, you know, making all of these puns and some of it is just funny. But yeah, you wonder some of the things that I discuss in the book, the moment where there's a game, I believe, versus the Devils and Travis Green and Ziggy Palfy end up kissing behind the net after a goal awkwardly. You know, can you imagine if that were to happen today and the gifts that would be instantly made and the, you know, the videos posted online, just all these sorts of jokes at the Islanders' expense immediately. So maybe the Islanders are lucky that social media didn't exist back then because a lot of this stuff flew under the radar. And that was kind of what was also fun for me to look back on with this period of like, can you imagine if, you know, Barry Trotz today was doing the stuff that Mike Milbury was doing back then? Can you imagine the media attention? It would be nonstop on TV. It would be, you know, there'd be a trillion podcasts like yours out the next morning talking about it. So maybe they're lucky they didn't unveil the Fisherman logo in that era.
Yeah. And even before this season, before they released this version of the third jersey, people were worried that the Fisherman jersey was coming back as a third jersey.
Right. And yeah, that was, there was a discussion this summer about it and I was reluctant to wade into it. And I did like post a few tweets when that was all going down because obviously I have a lot of opinions on the Fisherman jersey, but there's still something about that logo that, you know, divides the fan base. There's some people who I think grew up with the 80s teams and see that logo as being such a departure. They can never accept it. They don't want to hear anything about it. And it just dredges up bad memories. And I realized that even going into this project, you know, a few people may be thinking that I'm like a Rangers fan or something, and that's why I would research this. I mean, trust me, I am a lifelong Islanders fan. I've never been a Rangers fan. I love everything about this team. I just thought it was a really interesting story to tell. But you know, there's then there are a lot of fans, I think more of my generation, who grew up after the Fisherman logo was used, you know, or don't really have that kind of negative association with it because they weren't paying attention to Mike Milbury's hiring and Kirk Muller not coming and John Spano going to jail and all that. They just kind of view it as the logo of their youth, or maybe a logo of even before they were, you know, born, or before they were, you know, serious hockey fans. And it's just a nice retro look for them. So there's, I guess that's going to happen for a while. But, you know, I go to a lot of games to this day, and I'm sure as they return to Nassau Coliseum, there's going to be a lot of people in the stands wearing the Fisherman jersey.
Yeah. Well, the book, We Want Fish Sticks, The Bizarre, Infamous Rebranding of New York Islanders by Nick Hirshon, forward Eric Fischow. It's University of Nebraska Press. It comes out this Saturday. Makes a great holiday present. The book is fantastic. I'm going to read it again soon. Nick, thank you for a few minutes today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking about this and connecting with Islanders fans, so I really appreciate you having me on.